Making a great cocktail is a true art that's made even better when you can get the right spirits for them. Fortunately, in the South, a growing number of daring entrepreneurs are risking a lot to distill their own spirits, and I don't mean bathtub moonshine. I mean good quality, rare drinks made with a lot of care. They're the kind of spirits that mixologists who are obsessed with craft cocktails seek out. It's something I recently saw up close from one of the bartenders at Haberdish, a restaurant in Charlotte, North Carolina.
My name's Jamie Marsicano, and I'm a bartender here. I'm about to make the smoked mint julep, which is one of our specialty drinks. So to start, we're going to grab some mint leaves and gonna go ahead and muddle them into our copper cup. Just to kind of wake up the mint leaves. Then we're going to take our shaved ice and put it in. This drink is a really cold drink. It's served in the spring and summertime is when it's popular, so that's why we use a lot of shaved ice in a copper mug. You got this big mint sprig that kind of fans out from the drink, and then it's a little orange on top of the snow cone, which is what the Angostura gives that color. Yeah, it makes me think of the snow cone desserts that I had as a kid. It makes me think about watching like the Kentucky Derby with, because the juleps are a big drink there. Dressing up, a lot of people dress up at the races, and this drink is definitely dressed up. It's super smoky, but also minty and a little sweet too, so I think it's really well balanced, and you can't really find a mint julep like that anywhere.
Pouring a glass of Mixology 101. I'm Sean Chavis, and this is the Folklore Podcast. Cookbooks do more than help us get dinner on the table. To me, really good ones read like novels. The best cookbooks don't just make us better cooks, they make us better people. They tell stories that take us to new places, they connect us to people we haven't met, and they tell us a ton about ourselves. And that's what Folklore is about. Every other Sunday, I invite you to come into the kitchen with a cookbook author. We'll cook a recipe and hear about the stories behind their cookbook. Craft distilling is booming in America, and in the South, there's far more to it than Kentucky bourbon, Tennessee whiskey, and moonshine. You gotta hop in the car with the right tour guide.
We ended up doing 6 trails that cover 11 southern states. Mm-hmm. I went to 54 distilleries in 13 months.
I guess we found our tour guide. Kathleen Purvis is the food editor of the Charlotte Observer, and she's the author of a new book, Distilling the South. I met up with her at a restaurant in Charlotte, North Carolina. Kathleen told me the growth in craft distilling is huge.
It's exponential. I mean, everybody's seen what happened with craft brewing. Well, now the same thing is happening with craft distilling. It's just it's taking a little longer because, you know, beer, you can set up a brewery and you can start making beer in a matter of months. It's, you know, you get the funding, it's not hard to do. Distilling is more expensive, it's a little bit harder. Usually it's about 2 years before you really start having anything, and it might be 20 years before you have something that's, you know, really aged and really special. But these people are staking their lives on it. I mean, that was one of the most exciting things about it, was the people I met who were so focused on doing this, and they so much believe in what they're doing. So, yeah, it's when I started looking at the growth rates, I mean, it's just crazy. The bar chart that you would do to show, you know, how fast this is happening nationally, mm-hmm. you know, every year it's doubling and tripling in the number of distilleries.
Mm-hmm. And then you also kind of addressed what a different breed of entrepreneur it is and how they're... I don't think of that. Like, I usually am focused on what am I drinking. But uh-huh. then to read about, you know, how they're entrepreneurs and how they're impacting their local economies, that was really interesting.
Yeah, these are people who are really expressing themselves. I mean, the thing was, when I started out, and it seems kind of an obvious question within the distilling industry, people roll their eyes when you ask this, but it's a legitimate question. You know, when we started out with craft brewing, there was a reason for craft brewing, because there was terrible American beer. I mean, let's face it, American beer for a long time was nasty, and it was watered, and it was not that great. And Europe had all this great beer, and then we started having people making great American beer. We already had great American liquor. You know, it ain't like America was making bad whiskey.
Right.
So you have to go to these people and say, why on earth do you think that you can make something better than, you know, a Jack Daniel's or a Woodford Reserve or a Maker's Mark. You know, why would you stake your whole life on trying to do that? And that was one of the questions I really wanted to get to people. And I found a variety of answers, but they all had sort of in common the same thing. I really, you know, I was sitting around with my friends. I was drinking this. I was thinking how much I loved it. And we started saying, gee, well, I wonder if you can make this. You know, I wonder if I could do this. The other thing that really was, I think, a driver, and I've seen this in several areas of the food world, is around when we had the big crash in 2008, a lot of people were either offered buyouts or they lost their jobs or they were coming out of business school, but the banks weren't hiring. And so what we've seen all over craft food are all these people who came out of school, needed something to do, a job, and they decided instead of just having a job, they wanted to make something that was theirs. And so we've seen this explosion in craft bread and craft cheese and charcuterie and, you know, all of these different products. And this is really a part of the same thing. This is a craft food just like everything else in the craft food movement.
There are several things that really jumped out to me, like the limoncello.
I started off the book with the limoncello.
Yeah.
Who knew you would find them making limoncello from lemons that are growing in West Virginia?
Lemons in Virginia, I was like,
I know,
really?
I know. It's the first page of the book has a picture that I took inside this greenhouse on the side of a mountain about 15 minutes from Harper's Ferry. So it's like northern West Virginia.
Wow.
And I'm surrounded by lemon trees. And I'm standing there just kind of doing it. What? how can this be? But yeah, it was a couple who had gone to Italy to the husband's great-great aunt was going to be beatified by the Catholic Church. And wow. So they went to Rome for the ceremony. And while they were in Rome, they got a bottle of limoncello, fell in love with it, came back to America, started buying American limoncellos and realizing they weren't that good. Because they tend to, in America, most of the American limoncellos are made with pith that they use. They use machine to get it off, and it takes too much of the pith off with the zest, and so it makes it bitter. And so they wanted to do it by hand and see if they could make something as good as what you find in Italy. And now they have a line of 10 different cordials they do. It's called Bloomerie Distillery, and they have these sweet shine cordials, and so they do like black walnut, and they've got... Oh man, they got some crazy flavors. Hawaiian ginger. It's a blast of a place to go visit.
Nice.
But it's tucked up in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I was literally like, I go to pull off the road to drive up there, and I'm looking at this dirt road going uphill, and then you get halfway up, and there's a sign that says, yes, just accelerate. You'll make it. Keep going.
Keep going.
Keep going. We're up here.
Almost there.
Cool. Yeah.
What was the most surprising thing you found?
Man, I found people who were doing expressions of their lives. One of my favorite places that I went to is in Georgia. It's about 2 hours south of the Atlanta airport, and it is called Richland Rum, and it's in Richland, Georgia. And it's a couple who, they're both Dutch. He came over here as a child, as a baby. She was 18, was raised by a farmer in Holland. And so when she always wanted to go back to the land, she always wanted to grow things. He was fascinated by sugarcane and rum because of the West Indies. You know, the Dutch started all of that in the West Indies. And so he was very interested in history. And so they were going to just grow sugarcane for their own amusement and make rum just for themselves as a hobby. And they decided to do it legally, so they got a liquor license. And the mayor of this little abandoned town, it was like at one time a bustling agricultural farm town, but everything had pulled out. They'd literally pulled up the railroad tracks in this town. Wow. They're like gouged into the earth where the railroad tracks were. And there were all these abandoned buildings. And so the mayor of Richland, Georgia, went to them and said, you know, would you open a distillery in my town? And she said, no, there's nothing there. And he said, yeah, I know. I need something there. I need something that will have a tax base. And so they said, they came in, they looked at all these old buildings, and they said, okay, you know, we get these buildings really cheap, so let's do it. And so they have this big distillery now, and now they're actually attracting other business back to town. There's a chocolate maker that had come in. There was a brewery when I was there. There's somebody outside of town who's doing olive oil. You know, I mean, there's industry coming back to Richland, Georgia because of this distillery, because people go there to experience it.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's a good, I've had that rum before.
It's know, delicious. I love their rum. My husband calls Richland rum the bourbon of rums.
Wow.
It is a really good craft rum. There's some good rum out there.
You're listening to Kathleen Purvis, food editor at the Charlotte Observer and author of a new book, Distilling the South. Over the years, I've heard Kathleen say several times that writing about food is another way to write about people. One of the people telling the story of the South through cocktails is Colleen Hughes. She runs the beverage program at Haberdish, a restaurant and bar in Charlotte. Colleen told me about some of the challenges of getting certain spirits to her bar.
Well, so North Carolina is a very, very liquor-controlled state. So if it's made in North Carolina, I can get it. That's mm-hmm. not a problem. But the more artisanal craft spirits that are getting made in other states that may not actually have national distribution, they might not be distributed out of their state. That's a big thing. A lot of them, they're still growing, or they're maybe in their state and one other. So they don't quite have the volumes to ship out. I mean, that's a big thing with those small distilleries. And then access to them, hearing about them. It's a lot of money for these little guys to promote themselves into other states, to hire people to go out and rep their products. They might be in the portfolio of one of the major liquor distributing companies, but that doesn't mean that they're getting pushed. You know, they're not getting moved to the forefront. And so that's another big one. So we kind of have to hear about them. We have to find out about them. When I go to like New Orleans for Tales of the Cocktail, or when I travel quite a bit, I'm always trying to see what's out there, try the new stuff, go to the tasting tables, take notes, attempt to not get hammered.
Good luck.
and try to source some interesting stuff. But even with what would be considered sort of major players in other states, they don't really have any representation here. I think the best example I can give is Anchor Distilling. We have no Anchor Distilling products really here, and the few that we do pull, you know, and they've got a huge portfolio, the few that we do pull is because I had them in New Orleans, said, oh my gosh, this is amazing, I want to bring this back to my restaurant, and then we have to go through that whole special order process to get them.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why I wanted to do this as a book was because a lot of the ways these people promote themselves and sell their product is through tours. And so, you know, it's not a book for just for bartenders. I'm hoping I hope the bartenders don't laugh at me for my information. I hope I got everything right. But it's really aimed at people who want to go out and experience something hands-on. I mean, it'll change how you ever look at a drink. When you go into a distillery and you stick your finger in the vat of corn and you get down to the end and where the parrot is, and you see the actual liquor coming out, and you can put your finger in that stream and taste it, you will never think about that liquor the same way again. You'll have like a personal relationship with it. And when you go to drink it, it's this very, you know, emotional sort of sense. People, all the distilleries are telling me about people who come in and want them to sign their bottles.
Wow.
Because they want to be able to go home and say, hey, you know, I met the guy, he signed my bottle, and, you know, I was in the place where they grew this corn. People love that experience. And so that's why I wrote it as a tour book, so that you can go and do this. You can go see these people.
I have a lot of signed bottles from when I got to go through and do a lot of the Bourbon Trail. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, come on. Like, when I got to meet, like, the heads of Makers and when I got to drink with Freddie Noe, you bet your butt I had him sign a bottle. Like,
yeah. I'm running into these guys who are small, and they're having people come to them and ask to sign their bottle, and they're just like, oh, my God, they're acting like I'm a rock star.
It's amazing. I mean, and they are.
Yeah. They are. And someday they may be the Freddie Noe of liquor. We, you know, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, some of these guys are going to be famous. And you'll be able to say you went and saw them.
What makes these spirits Southern and local?
Mm-hmm.
Can you
exactly.
talk about that?
Exactly. I did a section in here, and I had to do the same thing in the bourbon book. The South is a really interesting place. A lot of things came together here. You had people from African countries who were coming over here who are believed to have had some distilling knowledge before they got here. You had the Irish and Scottish immigrants who have certainly brought a knowledge of distilling here. And then what happened when they got here, they, particularly in the mountainous areas around Kentucky and Tennessee, discovered one of the lucky accidents of history was that those areas have wonderful water. And they have great water because they're covered by limestone white marble, and it filters the water that's in the aquifer below the rock. And so they had this wonderful iron-free, sulfur-free water. And so when you put those things together with a copper still, you ended up with amazing alcohol. You also had a place where you could grow things like rye and corn, both the bases of a lot of whiskeys. And you had the remoteness of a lot of these areas where you were a long way from the government, and we can get into the whole history of the whiskey rebellion if we must. But a lot of people kind of went back further into the mountains where they weren't as likely to be taxed. And then the other lucky accident was in the area along Kentucky. You have the Ohio River, and if you take a barrel full of whiskey and you put it on a raft in the Ohio River and you float it downstream and float it downstream until you get to the Mississippi River, eventually you get to New Orleans, and you've got a huge market down there where you can sell these things. So all that stuff kind of came together, and the history of the South is almost intrinsically interwoven with the creation of alcohol. You just had everything here and people who knew how to do it and make it better.
More and more I'm seeing people acknowledging the African-American and African influence on an American spirit, and that's what truly makes it American, is just this influence from all different cultures, mm-hmm, including mm-hmm. African-Americans.
Yeah, you have, when you're talking about liquor in the South particularly, many of these things have very deep roots and they go back a long way. And so they did go back to the days of slavery. And a lot of enslaved people were the laborers who made a lot of these things and had that knowledge. And you do see places where that's being acknowledged now. I know Jack Daniel's is doing a better job, finally, of recognizing. One of the places where I was really moved by it was at the Mount Vernon distillery that George Washington started, where almost all the labor would have been enslaved people. And when you were there, they have costumed interpreters who actually are making whiskey. You get to go in and watch them doing it the old way over wood. And but upstairs in the visiting center, they have a film that was made by the History Channel, I think. And they used black actors in it to show the kind of work that was done. I noticed that they seem to be dressed a heck of a lot fancier than they probably would have been. Their clothes wouldn't have been so nice as they are in that little film, but at least they're giving some credit to this, and people are being allowed to see that, you know, that work that started out, and it was, you know, it's like barbecue, man. It's hard work making whiskey. Mm-hmm. It's hot, it's dirty, it takes a long time, and it takes a lot of physical labor. And a lot of that labor was done by enslaved people.
The story that's really coming out now is about how an African-American gentleman was the one who taught Jack Daniels how to distill.
That is being debated and discussed right now.
I think they just built a statue to him.
Yeah, and that's, you know, for a long time, nobody talked about those things. Of course, there's also some pretty unsavory history in American whiskey. There have been books written. Robert Moss's book on Southern spirits is a really good one to read, where they go into things like bad whiskey that was sold to the Indians. And, you know, I mean, some of these early distilleries were kind of unsavory. You know, some of that history gets a little washed over, I think, when you go into the mainstream distilleries. But I think at some of the smaller ones, there's more recognition, too. One thing I haven't seen yet that I'm waiting for is I did not find a black-owned distillery. I was really hoping that I would, and I have heard of a couple of people who are trying to start them, but it's so hard to get the funding together that we haven't seen this happening yet. I think we will. I know there was one guy here in Charlotte who was trying really hard, and he just hasn't been able to get the money together to get a space for it. I did see an awful lot of African Americans in tasting rooms who, you know, are... The people that I saw in tasting rooms were from millennials to baby boomers. It's really kind of interesting who you see in the act doing the actual tastings, the people out there touring who are interested in it. I hear that this kind of travel is very popular with millennials. It's very popular with baby boomers. Not so popular with Gen Xers because they're all home raising their kids and they can't get out and travel.
Gotcha.
But they'll be out there eventually.
It'll happen.
But we are starting to see a lot of diversity in the people buying things and visiting and, you know, getting to know this industry. I have a section in my book on mansplaining.
And I saw that.
The problem of mansplaining in distilleries. Yeah. There are a lot of women making who are master distillers, who are the ones in their family who are actually doing the distilling. And they say that women have an advantage because our taste buds are different than men's. And so we can, physiologically, we can pick up more tastes. sometimes than men do. But I heard from an awful lot of those distillers who told me, you know, a dealer will come in looking to sell them supplies, and it'll be, oh, well, I need to speak to the distiller. Can you call your husband for me? And they just kind of go, oh, God, again, really? My husband and I were out touring one time, and we noticed that if I asked a male distiller a question, they would turn and answer my husband. You know, we run into that all the time. People don't expect women to be involved in the alcohol industry, but we are.
And have been.
Women really were the original distillers. That was homework.
Because it was home craft. Yeah. It was, yeah, something you could do at home. Your husband might be out doing the fields and the livestock, and you would be the one making the alcohol that, you know.
I've read in numerous books about really that women founded distilling, you know, going back into the Genevers and to like the more historical styles. It was always women doing it. But yeah, I think it's always been there.
Thank you so much, Kathleen and Colleen, for giving us some time to speak with you and taste your wonderful cocktails and talk about the tours that you put together in Distilling South.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And the number of women creating spirits will no doubt continue to grow. You just heard Colleen Hughes. She's the beverage manager at Haberdish in Charlotte, North Carolina. We're also joined by Charlotte Observer food editor Kathleen Purvis. Kathleen's new cookbook is called Distilling the South, A Guide to Southern Craft Liquors and the People Who Make Them. Now, what kind of food podcast host would I be if I didn't offer you a drink? So you can find the recipe for Colleen's smoked mint julep that we heard being made at the top of the show on our website, folklorepodcast.com. You'll also find some behind-the-scenes photos there, too, and a link to buy the book. Finally, we're giving away a copy of Distilling the South to one of our listeners, so enter that giveaway on our website, folklorepodcast.com. And that's our show for today. Join me in 2 weeks. We're cooking with chef and author Virginia Willis. We'll talk to her about her new book, Secrets of the Southern Table. I'm Sean Chavis, your host and founder of Salt Shaker Marketing and Media, content marketing for food, wellness, and tourism companies. Folklore is a production of Salt Shaker, and we're based in Atlanta. You can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, Stitcher, and anywhere podcasts are found. Sean Powers is our executive producer. Michelle Curry runs our website and social media. Demetric Brown is our behind-the-scenes photographer. We'd all love to hear from you. Is there an author you've wished you could cook with? Let us know on Facebook and Instagram. As we finish this episode, I'd like to show respect to someone who was really great at using food as a lens to look at life. Anthony Bourdain took us around the world in the name of finding something good to eat. But that was a means to introduce us to places, cultures, and people, and he strove to keep it real. Anthony Bourdain, rest your soul. Thanks for the company.